All right, Sunday Drive Home Podcast. Here's another piece of audio. Man, it's coming fast and furious on the old podcast here. Pastor Brian Wolfmuller here, by the way. Pastor of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Austin, Texas. Come visit sometime soon. This is a conversation, this is a long one, a conversation I had with Dr. Gregory Schulz about the limits of science. It really got good when he started talking about Wittgenstein's Tractatus. Man, that makes me sound smarter than I am. And the four things that science can't know. And when he says that science can't read sacred text, which is why Dr. Fauci never quotes the Declaration of Independence, it all comes around. So if you can stick it out to the end, no doubt you'll take away something really helpful from this conversation. So hope you enjoy it. This is maybe one you want to take some notes on. Jot down a few things that you want to study on yourself. This is, again, conversations, dropping the audio from the YouTube, and hopefully there'll be more like this. If you like it, let me know. Thanks. Science. It seems like there's no limit on what science can do, which is not true, but seems like it. But what can science know? What can science tell us about what's true? This is a conversation that I have with Dr. Greg Schulz, who's professor of philosophy at Concordia University in Wisconsin. A wonderful conversation. I think I mentioned at the end, I'm twice as smart as I was when I woke up this morning. So you want to get out some paper and pen to take some notes, and please enjoy this conversation. If you have thoughts or questions, please post those up in the comments below. I hope this is the first in a series of conversations that we'll be able to have. It's a long one, so you can stop and go. And catch up on it. It's also, well, I don't know. You know, YouTube, you can watch videos, but I don't think you want to speed this one up. There's just a lot in there to try to absorb. So enjoy it. God's peace be with you.
Well, good morning, Dr. Schulz. Brian Wolfmuller here. If you guys are watching this, I have with me Dr. Gregory Schulz, who's a philosophy teacher, also a pastor at Concordia University. Which one? I should know which one. Concordia.
Wisconsin.
Oh, that's yeah. Also author, everyone should go get Wednesday's Child, From Heidegger to Affective Neuroscience, A Field Theory of Angst. But most of you probably have that book. I have it on my show. But maybe the more popular book that Dr. Schulz has written is The Problem of Suffering, which is a beautiful text. It's been revised recently. It's been found very helpful. A theological meditation on and pastoral meditation on suffering. But what we're going to talk about today is the limits of science, because when was that? A month or so ago at a doxology retreat, Dr. Schulz was talking about science and scientism, the limits of science, how science ought to have a natural limit on its own capacity to declare truth, but that what we face nowadays is science unbounded, I would say. Science that has transgressed those boundaries. And maybe that transgression started to happen a long time ago. I was very intrigued by the conversation. And I think this will have some really helpful applications to things like the conversation we're having about COVID, and how, if you don't say science with the appropriate amount of reverence these days, you might be put at the stocks. So you have to say science with awe, as if that it deserves our worship. So, Dr. Schulz, that's the topic of the conversation. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well, Pastor. How are you, Brian?
God be praised. Just fantastic. We were talking about yesterday, in fact, about one of the first moves that we want to investigate is the move of science from observation to control. Is that too much of a simplification that happened at the time of Descartes?
I think it's a good starting point. So, if it's okay with you, I'll just cast this as the philosophy or history of ideas in Western culture. So how about the thought that prior to 1600, which would be the start of modernity, the basic approach to science, which would be the more original approach, scio from Latin, seeking to know things, the basic approach was to discover who we are and what our place is in the universe. The Greeks would have said within the cosmos. And for the Greek period, from 400 BC to 400 AD, from Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle up to Augustine, that was the quest to understand. And then from Augustine, also starting medieval philosophy about 400 AD up to 1600, for the medieval thinkers, that was pretty much exactly what they were after. We've even got Latin phrases for it, right? Credo ut intelligam, I believe, for the purpose of going on to understand. Then with a tectonic shift, almost a change from one universe to the next, smack dab on 1600, at exactly the time of the beginning of the scientific revolution, René Descartes and Thomas Hobbes and others are changing the purpose of knowledge and science. So after our conversation yesterday, I was double checking this. So I have a textbook that I use in one of our courses. We have a great texts course for philosophy books. This is my least favorite book to teach in that. It's called A Discourse on the Method by René Descartes. You can find this online. And Descartes says this in his sixth section in here. It says, we need to make ourselves the masters and possessors of nature. We have to see if it is possible to find some way of making men in most cases wiser and more skillful than they have been hitherto. And he goes on to say, I believe that it is in medicine that it must be sought. So how about just to give us a bit of a peg to hang that thought on? Science goes from the project of understanding what it means to be human beings in the cosmos or in God's creation to a Bob the Builder project. This is the way I teach it in bioethics. So our thoughts with science today is along the lines of that cartoon character, beloved cartoon character. Can we fix it? Yes, we can. So the problem, I would say, is that without the understanding of the human being and our place in God's creation, how do you know whether you're fixing something or fixing something, right? So science today is a very different kind of thing than it was in the earlier history of Western thought.
Was that idea challenged in Descartes' time? Or was it just a sort of an idea that captivated the imagination? Or were there people saying, no, you're thinking about it wrong?
Well, that's a hard one to give a comprehensive answer to. I think it would be fun to see if we've got some, literary cautions, what we might almost think of today as humanity cautions against this sort of thing going on. But for somebody I can just kind of lay my hand on right away, John Donne, at the beginning of modernity, has some poetic lines that go, everything hath been flung to its atomies. Each hath got to be a phoenix, and no man can teach him, and I have to paraphrase here, no man can teach him what it means to be a human being. So there is a recognition of the fragmentary characteristic now of modern science and the modern worldview. But I don't really know. I think that the need to object doesn't really come on the scene until a bit later. So it's relatively easy to see this in retrospect, but it's only when you hit the Enlightenment, and then maybe even when you hit contemporary bioethics, which I've been characterizing as the bioethics of death on demand. It's only when you see things so egregious and so off the rails that you go back to find what are the roots of the problem here. And I would say the root of the problem is René Descartes and the switch to the manipulation of nature by science.
Does that switch carry with it? Because there's always an anthropology. There's always a statement of this is what humanity is. So the previous conversation was what is a human being and where do we fit in the universe? But if you switch to we are the masters and possessors of nature, you have a sort of assumed anthropology, but now it remains unquestioned. It's now assumed who we are, that we are the great manipulators, that we are now entering into the work of the creator in some way.
Right. So the Bob the Builder mentality has become a presupposition. So as you say, it's something that's so widely assumed that folks don't even pause to acknowledge it or to defend this as an approach to things. And, you know, as you suggested, I think it's plain as day that we actually see this in the handling of the COVID politics today too. The abuse of science, or I suppose most would prefer to say a particular idolization of science. You called it scientism a minute ago, and I think that's pretty apropos.
I want to get to that. I want to work our way towards it, because so just to make sure that I'm with you on this. So this question then of man as manipulator of nature becomes the program of the scientific revolution, of also the Enlightenment, because I don't think the Enlightenment would have been characterized that way, at least as I learned about it. But does that become now the definition of modernity, or only a part of that?
Right. So if it's okay to start with a description instead of a definition for at least a few minutes, you could characterize, I do this with my intro classes and with our core course Introduction to Western Thought at my university. I say you can think about that Greek period of philosophy, which is really the start of the West, right? From 400 BC to 400 AD. Think of that as the period of courting or dating reason and wisdom. Then with the fullness of time right in the middle of that period, and then the availability of God's revealed word for the Western conversation when we get to Augustine and so forth, 400 AD, then the medieval period is characterized by the marriage between faith and reason. And it may be a somewhat tumultuous kind of thing with some of the medieval thinkers, and at certain periods from about 400 AD to 1600 with Descartes, but that's a basic characterization. Then, bam, right on 1600, now it's the divorce of faith from reason. And that shows up in science. It shows up in our use of the word science, if you think about it. What counts as knowledge? Experimental, observational stuff, things that fit within the scientific canon and the scientific method. And then probably right along with that, it's fair to say, since we've both mentioned the Enlightenment, that there's an increasing illiteracy, if not a genuine kind of hatred for Christ and the scriptures. So you've got a sort of emptying of the soul, and then let's just borrow a term, the human soul or the soul of a culture abhors a vacuum. And what fills that in is the scientific method, scientific knowledge, which, as we've started to observe, is really for manipulation.
Now, you mentioned when we were talking yesterday too about wanting to make sure that we hit this this development from the epistemological side of things as well. So the question of how do you know, how do you know a thing, or how and I suppose even how are you defining truth, and how do we get to it? And so that's all shifting in this time as well.
Yes, it is. So did we just start an entire new series there with things we're going to have to cover to have a good, helpful discussion about the role of science in our lives today? Well, right. So why don't we stick with your cue about epistemology or knowledge? So it also is the case, by the way, that epistemology became a big deal all by itself, divorced from other ways of doing things, pretty much smack dab on Descartes as well. So the notion of epistemology is an area of study in philosophy that I would characterize as the conversation surrounding three basic questions. What do we know? How do we know it? And can we be sure? What do we know? How do we know it? And can we be sure? So we could jump just to, you know, looking at things in modern terms, but we're trying to follow something of the historical development or the devolution of thinking about knowledge. So just to catch one thing, prior to 1600 and before Descartes, those questions of epistemology were asked, in my professional view, in a we mode. What do we know? How can we know it? Can we be sure? And as you know, all of us know, with or without having really read very much Descartes, Descartes switches that all to a Lone Ranger model. Or if you like the, you know, kind of the fancier terms, a solipsistic, a solo thinker model. And he changes the question to, what do I know? Can I be sure? You know, it's the first person singular pronoun. And then certainly that has a lot to do with the success of a godless worldview that becomes more and more prominent in modernity too. So the self, also an invention of the modern period, by the way, but the self or the individual becomes the locus of attention and experiment and, well, will to fix it. Yes, we can.
Oh, there's so much that. So I missed that, the we to the I thinking. I'm sorry I wasn't paying attention when you probably told me 20 times. But so this is hard for us. But so could you take us back or take me back to before Descartes? The identity would be bound to family, to place, to. If the individual and the individual will is not the center of being, how can you explain how that was? I mean, I imagine it's impossible for us to get back there and feel it in some real way, but
that is a great question. I don't think it's impossible. It's just that it's countercultural. So the key to all of this is texts. The key to all of it is texts. So are we going to settle for the text of nature as, let's say, the natural sciences since Newton have talked about things? Are we going to confine ourselves to the writings and the thinking done only in the last couple hundred years or even in contemporary sciences this century or something? Or are we going to pay attention to the historical texts of wisdom? Now, this does mean reaching back to Augustine, I think, and it does mean reaching back to the Greeks. I am not surprised, but amazed, if I can put it this way, how often my undergrad students, or for that matter, some of you that I get to serve who are out in ministry, and some of our missionaries and pastors in the PhD teaching I do, I'm amazed at how hungry and thirsty people are for, let's say, Aristotle's view of human nature versus the blasé, hollow, thoughtless views of human nature we have today. So a way to do this, though, you said, how could we feel this difference? I'm going to take a couple pages from Norman Melchert's masterful textbook, The Great Conversation. This is the textbook we use for our introductions to Western thought and worldview.
I have it within grasp.
It's on every thoughtful person's shelf. Yes, there we go, right, yeah. Yeah, so Melchert has most everything in his book has been, I think, just a real blessing for looking at Western thought. But he has this observation with the switch from the Greek and medieval thinking to the worldview of modernity. And he recommends two literary texts. So to get the feeling for and some knowledge of the pre-modern worldview, how about Dante's Divine Comedy? So in Dante's Divine Comedy, we have a couple features. Can we just skate by without appreciating his amazing literary, philosophical, and theological work for a minute? But we've got two big features to the Divine Comedy. In those three books, Hell and Purgatory and Heaven, there is this overarching symmetry, right? So there's an expectation that things are related and connected and orderly, so much so that, as I'm sure most of our friends listening in on our conversation will recognize, the Inferno or the Hell part there are various circles of hell that go around and around and around and around until you get to the deepest circle where Satan himself resides. So the symmetry is a big deal. By the way, though, a lot of the graphic novelists don't get on to that wonderful heaven part. They all seem to make their home in hell, interestingly enough. But if you get onto the heaven part, the paradiso, the symmetry is there too. And it turns out that the symmetry is, and here's the second big part of the pre-modern worldview, is God-centered. So just as we see each person of and the Trinity at the center of the throne in the book of the Apocalypse, the revelation at the end of scripture, so in Dante, we see that in his poetry, that God is at the center of everything. And there's a college of angels around all the souls of the people who are around God on his throne. Now, that's a glimpse at, and I think you can, by reading some of Dante, you can get a feeling for what it's like to be in a medieval mindset or a pre-modern mindset, symmetrical, God-centered. But then the literary example that Melchert offered is the one from John Donne that I started to try to quote before, where he talks about everything being flung to its atomies, everything atomized. Each hath got to be a phoenix. No longer do the relations of father and son or daughter and child pertain. Everything is up for grabs. That's the modern mindset. Ooh. And then, right? And then what you've got is, on the one hand, kind of an explanation for science as being something of a self-centered enterprise, but you lose the God-centeredness and you lose the confidence in the order of the universe. I don't believe, by the way, that anybody can do science. I speak as a layman regarding natural science. I love reading about it. I don't have qualifications, but I would say it's actually not the case that you can do modern science assuming an unordered universe, because you know they're always assuming orderliness of a certain kind. But boy, it seems to be working with might and main to avoid any notions of God, or for that matter, the Greek logos, the ordering principle that's evident in both thinker and universe alike.
So that's what I wanted. That I'm glad you mentioned the logos, because this is what I was thinking about when you mentioned Dante. And this kind of, the universe is a circle with, so God is at the center, we're on the edges, versus this sort of scattering, like I dropped the popcorn on the floor, and that's the picture.
Yeah, yeah.
But would the Greek mind have had that understanding of, because it wasn't the gods at the center, but the, can you help me with that?
Yeah, so How about if we just run back to Heraclitus for a second? So Heraclitus is a pre-Socratic Greek philosopher who lived about 500 BC. Most of us know at least something about Heraclitus, even if we haven't picked up a philosophy textbook, because Heraclitus is the one who says things like, you both can and cannot step in the same river twice. The way up and the way down are one and the same. It's truly frightening to my first year students when I mention I'd really like to stop and talk about those aphorisms or philosophical proverbs for a couple weeks. They sort of get all worried over that. But Heraclitus was described by Plato as the philosopher of flux and change. But here's where the logos comes in. Heraclitus is not somebody we'd be paying any attention to at all if he seriously thought everything was chaos all the time, because that's a very thoughtless, unreflective dogma or opinion. Actually, if you can see change taking place, it must be the case that something is staying put. So for instance, the universe itself must be orderly if we can talk about things within the universe or cosmos. And the mind of the human being knowing anything must also be orderly, because we recognize change when we see it. And if everything were absolute chaos, we wouldn't have the language to talk about that. We wouldn't have the things that stay place for us to talk about and have knowledge of. And by the way, there wouldn't be an us either. You see? So that's where the logos comes in. Heraclitus named that orderly principle or orderly dimension to the cosmos and to the human mind as logos. And then, of course, the glory of that story. My goodness, Heraclitus was catching just the barest tip of the iceberg. An important catch, right? But then, you know, later on, by the way, in Heraclitus's own hometown, his hometown was Ephesus. In his hometown, the Apostle John, to the best of our knowledge, that's the spot where he wrote, in the beginning was the Logos. The Logos became flesh, and tabernacled for a while among us. And now, you know, as Paul Harvey used to say, the rest of the story.
Oh, right? Fantastic.
So anyhow, this commitment to recognition of Logos orderliness is there from the very start of Western thought with Heraclitus. In fact, you know, we could go on and on here. Aristotle says, for instance, that the human being is the zoon logon ekon, the logos species. So logos is conversation. And I just point out that conversation has to be orderly or it can't exist. So that wonderful Greek word that you and I have been preaching on for years, and it's always something new to talk about, right? That starts off as a recognition from the Greek philosophers, Heraclitus, Aristotle, for instance, but it reaches its full flower, or if you will, the foundations, the remainder of the iceberg are revealed, only revealed, we can't get there ourselves, by the Apostle John.
Now, okay, so talk about orderly conversation. This is a disorderly shift back to, but maybe not.
It's a deeper order here.
So the question of Western philosophy, which is how do we know the logos, and what do we know of it? How do we know it? Can we be sure of this? I mean, that was the thing to be known. Now science is going to replace not only the knowing. How do you know something, but what is it that we are to know as well? So that epistemological shift is both, I mean, it's a switch in the how, but also in the what. So, you know, what do we know and how do we know it? Nowadays, whenever you start to talk about theological truth, it's just assumed that it can't truly be known because it's theological. It's not scientific. The only things knowable are the measurable things. And so that's a fantastic shift that's there. So like maybe walk us through that shift a little bit or take us through that.
Okay, well, so very interesting. Let's just consider this. It's not exactly the case that the Greeks were seeking to understand the Logos, but it's rather the case that the reality of the Logos is a precondition for seeking or knowing anything.
Thank you.
So that the universe, the cosmos, the Greeks would say, is orderly, is a precondition of knowing the universe as the universe. And then the more interesting part, as far as I see it, is that the human mind is logos-like. So it is what? Some sort of a rejection of our humanity or a rejection of the way we've been created and redeemed to try to deny the logos either in the knower, the scientist or the person doing science, right? Or to deny that in creation itself. I think that's an undoable denial finally. You know, anytime you've got knowledge, the evidence is there that logos is a real feature of what's going on. However, people like Jacques Derrida in the very late modern period, as you know, have sought to reject Christ the Logos, and in his mania to get rid of Christ the Logos as the center of Western culture, center of gravity, really, you end up getting rid of, guess what, the Logos of reason and rationality, because those two have been so fused together in Western thought. But now, how about if we talk about that question about knowing with some focus right in the thick of things there where you were kind of leading us. So the question about how we know things should have something to do with what are the kinds of things that we need to know. And And the problem then with the scientific method is that it restricts the knowing in such a way that we can't look at all the things that as human beings we need to know.
So this is, you know what I mean? You tempted me to want to talk about postmodernity, but now that temptation is gone because this is the stake I want to bite into, right? Exactly what you said. So I need you to say that thing like five times in every different way.
Okay, well, how about sort of a C.S. Lewis essay for an illustration in the middle of our conversation, and then you just push me some more in which direction exactly you'd like to go. So my example is
Can I just try to repeat back what you said to before you get, don't lose this. Okay, sure. But the scientific method just in and of itself restricts what? The things restricts that are knowable.
Yep.
And it reduces it. So it's too small because as human beings, we need to know more than what the scientific method promises we can know. So that already from the beginning, just by its definition, the scientific method will give us a way of knowing certain things, but the things that it even promises to teach us are not enough. It's not a sufficient knowledge from the very get-go. Get it?
Yes. Yeah. So the problem is it's what you could call a methodological nearsightedness. An interesting thing is that René Descartes, and I do mean to make him a villain here. I think the easy breezy acceptance of stuff from Descartes, even if in class, you know, we can kind of handle him as being experimental and like inviting conversation, because he gets used so routinely, we're still recovering today from the Cartesian headache from 1600 in so many ways. But Descartes says it is a matter of method, and modern contemporary science has glommed onto the notion of method as its way of doing business, its way of doing science. So quite clearly, anything that lies beyond the reach of the method is opaque and unknowable by science. Right.
So your methodological nearsightedness is not just saying that the scientific method is nearsightedness, but that to be methodological is to be nearsighted.
Sure. Okay. Sure. But it's really clear in the scientific method. Now let's just say a kind word about contemporary science. Right. It is very powerful at what it is able to do. The problem is that whether it's in, you know, our popular notion of science, or I think, you know, all over the place today, we see trained scientists themselves overreaching in big ways. But the problem is that science doesn't stay on its own playing field. So science would be really good, should be really good, wouldn't you think, at talking about the natural features of the universe, which is to say matter and energy and matter energy systems. But the problem is that that's not everything. And, you know, I mean, from the scientific standpoint, that's the problem. But what does happen then, almost inevitably, is people who are then committed to the scientific method shrink their worldview so that the method fits their worldview. So this is the problem with methodism.
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, I mean this in a playful sense. The methodism, when you commit yourself to your method as the what, how you restrict yourself to knowledge, figuring things out, pretty soon you end up saying, whatever is beyond the reach of my method doesn't really exist, or it doesn't count, or it isn't science. Well, right. It's not. It's not science. So,
thank the Lord. So the Methodist Church became theological pietists and therefore became legalists. And the scientific method is a sort of epistemological pietism.
Pietism,
yeah. Becomes a legalism. I don't want to derail you from the C.S. Lewis essay. Can I guess, is this his essay from a tool shed?
Exactly. Meditation in a Tool Shed. So is it okay to do this?
Yeah. Oh, it's wonderful. Okay.
All right. So we won't lose sight. And besides, it's your job to keep me on track here. So... The in Meditation for a Toolshed, C.S. Lewis suggests that you have to be within what you're seeking to know, and you can't be objectively outside of it. And the title has to do with him stepping into a tool shed in his backyard. And when you close the door, there's a beam of light that comes through a chink in the shed. It is only if you step within that beam of light that you can see the real world of sun and clouds, or in the case of Great Britain, maybe rain and clouds, the world outside your current dark tool shed. So I think this just invites this kind of application. I'm simply doing a knockoff of Lewis. So anything good here is him. And if this doesn't do it for us, that's me. So I've thought with my folks in classrooms, when we're in actual classrooms these days, to ask them, okay, so suppose that our topic for today is we have to figure out what love is. Everybody wakes up. So what is love? And then I say, well, who are we going to go to help us understand what love is? And I said, I'll give you two basic choices. We could go to somebody in the psychology department. They tell us that they're scientists, right? And they've got white coats in their closets. We probably want to get somebody who is a neuroscience trained psychologist, and then we'll invite her to come to class. That'll be one option. Or we could grab one of those high schoolers who's going through in a tour group in the hall right now, making a racket. And so my question is, how do we have the better chance of learning what love really is, from a psychologist or from a high schooler out in the hallway? Well, I just spin this out a little bit. You can picture the psychologist bringing along some instrumentation, right? You can't be doing science, we're told, if you don't have the metrics for it. So she's going to produce all sorts of metrics. It involves putting electrodes on somebody's arm and probably on their head in a real-time PET scanner. So you can do something like this. Find two people in class who just got engaged or are seriously dating, and you know they're falling in love. So take one and put them out in the hallway or send them far away. Hook up the other one, and then bring the person that they love into the classroom. And what's going to happen? You're going to get all sorts of metrics about the conductivity of their skin. You can catch the blood pressure, probably the dilation of their eyes. And if our psychology people have some sort of much bigger budget than we ever get in philosophy, they would have real-time computer reads of various interesting things going on in the person's brain. And I said, and you could get a whole pile of data, right? Love is all of this stuff that we've plotted out to the nth degree. We've got bar charts and brain maps and everything else. And then they just kind of look at me because they suspect it's a philosophy class. Something's happening here. Mm-hmm. And I say, well, so what do you think? And some of them can always tell who the psychology majors are in the class too. But they, you know, I kind of look around. I say, well, you know what the problem is, right? The better source would be to grab that high schooler from the hallway, assuming that he is in love. Grab him and put him in the middle of class. We should talk about poetry and walks in the moonlight and love letters and what it means to be getting set to become engaged to somebody and what the Lord means for us in the institution of marriage. And then we'll be understanding what love is. So the scientist as scientist has no room for love.
Hmm.
There's no way to do this because, right, it's just what?
Can you imagine? I'm in love and someone starts to hook you up and says, but you don't have the right chemical in your amygdala or whatever to be truly in love.
So that's the problem with the scientific method. I mean, in one illustration, it's incompetent or impotent to teach us about, I think easily one of the most important features about being a human being. Also, what kind of view of the human person do the natural sciences provide us with? We come out greatly reduced. You might almost say amputated from our humanity. It's like having a frog pinned to the biology table. And the one thing you certainly cannot learn from that is the frogginess of the frog, right?
I had that jotted down here, the problem of dissection. is that to dissect something, you have to kill it. And this was a big problem in the Middle Ages, especially when they were taking cadavers and cutting them open, and the question of the morality of that. But this, because the scientific method will say then that knowledge is obtained through dissection. But there's like you said, there's certain things you can learn by dissecting a frog.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that if I were making that comment, there would be a scientific reply for it. But the main way I'd want to put this is that according to the scientific method, you cannot see the human being as a human being. You can only see them in terms of what the scientific method can deal with, as we broadly said before, the matter and the energy and the systems of matter and energy. You don't see the actual humanity.
Can you, and this is getting really close already to, you've already probably answered this question, but just to then highlight it. So of the things that science cannot know, just by its own definition, what would that list be? As here's the top five things that science can't, or whatever you number pick now, that science cannot know by definition, but that must be known for us to be fully human.
Yes, well, that's a wonderful lead-in for me to drop one more important name for this discussion, and that's the 20th century philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein. So Wittgenstein has a marvelous little book. At his death in the early 1950s, this was described as a philosophical poem, which was high praise in British circles for him. The book is called, ready, Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus. If you've ever read it or sat through a lecture like this once, you get to call it the Tractatus. Otherwise, you'll never finish taking down the reference. But in the Tractatus, in the way I teach it, Wittgenstein starts off by saying the world is all that is the case. But what you catch real quickly is he means the world understood according to the scientific method. We're going to say that the world, according to the scientific method, is all that is the case. That's the hypothesis of this book. Then he's going to work out what you can know, what you can't know, right? Now, the last statement in this amazing little philosophical poem is, whatever you can't speak of, you must be quiet. I call that the shut up principle sometimes. But on my understanding, and I think this is very contextual, that last statement is then really, whatever you cannot speak of scientifically, you need to shut up about scientifically. And then, as a matter of fact, to answer your question, Wittgenstein does say in the course of that brief, powerful little book, here are the things that cannot be said scientifically, but nonetheless show up in the human form of life. God, the soul, ethics, and aesthetics. God, the soul, ethics, and aesthetics. Now, in Wittgenstein's very careful wording, things that show up but can't be spoken scientifically, those would be outside the scientific method, right? So they're still there. He does not make this horrible mistake of saying, because they don't show up in my method, they must not exist. That's just an awful, awful conclusion. No warrant for that at all. But he does say, so this other stuff shows up, though it can't be said scientifically. So those would be four big things. So that would lead us to the realization that science as science is impotent to help us with ethical or policy decision-making in society.
Now that's going to have some, I mean, there's so many things here. I don't even. So this is where it becomes particularly practical, I suppose, is that we have. How would you describe the state that we are in now? So we're talking in 2021. 2021. Let's see what we. And so we're in the middle of what's defined as a pandemic with COVID, a number of other things. Always the question is, what is the science? So there's an assumed authority of science and almost sola science. I mean, it's almost now the one of the solas of whatever, right, in science alone. But that, even that is certainly not consistent and hypocritically kind of adjudicated. But you hinted at it, that science already lacks the capacity to make ethical judgments. So take it through there. And if you wouldn't mind, I'm glad you like my language of scientism, but that would be good to maybe define or put some flesh on that, so I'm not using it cautiously.
So how about so I don't let this slide by, why don't we say that anytime you find an ism as a suffix, that means that that word is or was historically a pejorative. Even, you know, like Lutheranism, right, mm-hmm, was originally a put down and something Luther didn't like either, of course. So scientism, it is not in usage, I would say, it's not a brainless anti-science put down, but it's a way of labeling, defining people who look to science for salvation. So scientism would be counting on science to save you. Now, some further defining would be necessary if we were going to talk about that much. So the salvation that science offers is only temporary or temporal. However, I don't even think it does that much, because if you say science does or more often will save us, I would just point out, as I started to do, that science doesn't have us in view. It's looking at our bodies and it's looking at the biosphere, I suppose, hence that awful prefix on bioethics, right? But it's...
Do you have a different word? I know you would...
Yes. That's another series for us. Okay. Yeah, no, so I use the term Zoe ethics. If you want to talk about ethics for human life, the word you need is Zoe. That's Aristotle's term for human life. And that's the New Testament term for human life, Zoe, not bios, which fits biology. But then, by the way, biology only studies the bios part, the physical systems part of the human being, strictly speaking. Okay.
While I get you, so I want you to, but could I, would this then be true? So scientism as an epistemological category would say that the things that science does not know are not known, or even in some ways do not exist. So science cannot tell us about God, the soul, ethics, and beauty. So someone who would be defined by scientism would say there is no God and there is no soul and there is no ethic and there is no, or the ethic becomes the will to power, I suppose, and there is no beauty. It just becomes, now the beauty could only be what?
A mere psychological hiccup or something.
Yeah. So that the things that science cannot know, if someone has been now defined by that, then that means anything that science cannot know cannot even exist.
Right. Or isn't real or doesn't count.
Yeah.
Right. That's an impoverished worldview at least, right? And then we were concerned with the overreach here. So what we can look at this in at least two ways, I think, with our brief conversation right now. One of them would be to stick with Wittgenstein just a little bit longer. So I mentioned that he's a 20th century thinker, and he basically covered the first half of the 20th century. He died in the early 1950s. We were referring to his work, Tractatus. At the same time that Wittgenstein was pointing out that scientifically speaking, you can't say anything outside of the reach of the scientific method, right? So you should just shut up. At that same time, this group that we know as the logical positivists, sometimes they're called the Vienna Circle, were in vogue in, guess where? Vienna. So these were these were guys who were primarily mathematicians and physicists, including, I think, some of the early Copenhagen physicists thinking about indeterminacy and stuff. They would get together for what sounds like, for all the world, like a weekly Bible study class, where they talk about how everything had to be handled scientifically. They came up with a watchword. This could almost be their statement of faith. A statement is meaningful if and only if it is at least in principle empirically verifiable. A statement is meaningful if and only if it is at least in principle empirically verifiable. And then by empirical, they meant by the scientific method, which doesn't really mean by experience, but it means by experience under the scientific method, under the, this narrow worldview we were talking about. All right, so guess which book they were using for their Bible study. It wasn't a book of the Bible. A fairly famous 20th century book. Don't say anything. Tractatus.
Oh,
Tractatus, you see.
They thought, were taking Wittgenstein and what, refuting?
They thought that this showed that if anything wasn't scientific, then it didn't exist. It was meaningless, which is the ultimate put down, you know. It's not right or wrong, it's meaningless. And Wittgenstein just refused to come and talk to them as their guest speaker because they had missed his point so badly, right? So that's a problem with science, of natural science as such. And then the other thing to consider here is, and I've got a quote for us, which I'm just gonna put up here. So this quote is from Kurt Marquardt, whom both of us, certainly Brian, but many of our listeners will probably recognize as quite a blessing to the conservative Lutheran Church Missouri Synod that we're part of, because of the way he helped to analyze problems that we were having a generation or two ago. So here's what he says in his Anatomy of an Explosion. Listen to this. Science has neither use nor room for privileged authorities or sacrosanct texts. It recognizes only observations, experiments, logical inferences based on them, and reluctantly, whatever axioms or assumptions are necessary to sustain these operations. Now, at the time, Marquardt was criticizing a scientific or pseudoscientific approach to Bible interpretation, which is, for reasons we've been talking about, obviously a very bad thing to do. That would make the Bible something that has to fit within scientific presuppositions rather than being the authority, the ultimate authority that really is. But that first part of his statement, science has neither use nor room for privileged authorities or sacrosanct texts. So did I have that on the screen?
No, but I
okay, so you got the quote.
I want you to build on that, but maybe just a quick on this. Does science know that about itself? Does it have that self-awareness that it lacks the capacity to, is it my question make sense?
I think, how about if we just make one quick cut in here? I think the scientists, by and large, who show up in the legacy media telling us things about how we have to act or what we have to do to our neighbors or have done unto us because of the COVID virus, right? They have no hesitation about entering into the area of moral authority. I do know a lot of scientists, you probably do too, who are not cursed with that arrogance, who have a humility about what they're doing and understand, as many of us should, what our areas of expertise can bring to the conversation, but that we are not omniscient or omnipotent or, you know, all embracing. So a big problem for us is that a lot of the science that, in the way it's used popularly and the way it's used in public education and probably university education overall too, is granting complete authority to the scientific method or to scientists prognosticating on things. And that this is beyond their purview. Just to take a real easy example and a quick one. If you think about, contemporary science books that write about how the universe started or how the universe is going to end up, I'd like to point out that that's actually beyond the reach of physics and science. Physics and science can operate on the universe as it is, but they are utterly incompetent if it comes to questions of origin or destiny for the universe, right? So what passes for cosmology should confine itself to the cosmos as it is, and I would think if they're being true to them, to their own methods, to the scientific method as it is, and not presume to do theological or philosophical work as if they've got competence in those areas of origin and destiny and so forth. And then this really does come to a head today. First of all, in education, the problem is the scientism, the mindset that uncritically declares whatever we need to know, science does it for us. And this truly bizarre assumption that science is going to make our lives better, even though science doesn't know what human life is. And then we've got pronouncements, certainly the most immediately egregious, by people like Fauci and other spokespersons who are, let's just say this with in line with Marquardt's comment, who have no room for sacred texts of any sort in their methodology or their training or their conversations. I don't think I have ever heard the oft-quoted authorities on, quote, the science of COVID. I don't think I've ever heard one of them ever quote the Declaration of Independence or the First Amendment to the Constitution. In other words, the sacred scriptures of the United States of America are beyond the purview, apparently, of the COVID science. So how good is this knowledge for us? How helpful is this knowledge in the final determination? Let's also realize that when people of religious integrity, and I mean Jewish and Christian people of the book, of the text, when they seek to speak up, just look at how dismissive the people telling us about the COVID science and what it means for our lives really are. When, of course, we notice that it's actually religious institutions that are coming under the microscope of COVID policies. So no room for sacred texts. Let's take the moderate step. No room for the sacred American texts, obviously. This is a major liability. How can you provide, quote, scientific reasoning that's appropriate for violating the Declaration of Independence and the US Constitution if you're never even taking the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence seriously in your methodology to begin with? If you can't speak about it scientifically, let's quote Wittgenstein, shut up about it scientifically.
That's fantastic. So that's really helpful. As a diagnostic on the state of the conversation, mm-hmm. and it helps understand the motivation that the scientist can't quote the text, which just to make a simple application, it means simply that they can't be in charge. They can be helpful as a servant, but you can't be in charge if you can't read. if you can't read the Logos, if you're just reading nature, then you and in fact only reading nature as it is and nothing of what nature says about beauty.
And just one more wrinkle there, and that is nature as you have preconceived it and confined yourself to methodologically. So human nature is opaque to contemporary science. Human nature, as we've come to understand it down through the centuries from the Greeks and from the authoritative input of scripture about creation and redemption and the undeletable, inalienable value of each and every human being because of the gospel, that is totally outside the scientific conversation. This is not an improvement. And you're right, it disables people from leading us or making decisions, or as I've said, offering anything for the ethical or policy decision-making.
You've made such big points that it feels wrong to go back to a couple of the minutia, but there's two little things that I want to pick up as we wind down. One is, and I think you would have tracked this down, the argument of Wittgenstein that science cannot speak of ethics. Has that argument been expanded and explored in different places? And because it seems like science would want to push back on that. And that would have maybe, is that then the will to power? Or in other words, where science would say, no, we can speak of ethics, of law, at least. We can govern society and humanity. So how is that argument expanded? That's one little gap that I'd love to have filled in.
Well, I don't know. Why don't you tell me what you think about this, and then maybe I can moderate or reorient my response. But I think that you were doing a very important thing when you talked about scientism before. So how about the thought that in our religion in our secular religion today, right? And you know, certainly follow Luther's, I think, very biblically and humanities and historically, and by the way, philosophically informed view on this stuff, where, you know, he says, well, look, whatever you love, fear, love, and trust in above all things, that's really your God, right? So secularism is a dominant faith. And the broadness and the depth of that assumption in contemporary society means that hardly anyone, I think, is interested in hearing, much less has participated in a conversation like we're having right now. Another factor that makes this even worse is the people who should be able to raise the caution or broaden the conversation as it needs to be far beyond the natural sciences, is that we're falling down on our responsibilities. I mean, we university professors, teachers generally, I think we're just not considering this stuff. Therefore, our students are starving for lack of this. So the surprising thing is that there is no notable opposition to the hegemony of science today. Can I do this without starting off on a political slant? But of course, we do realize that political leaders who use, quote, the COVID science for policymaking are in fact practicing a fallacy of ignorance. So, or to use your more brutal and I think more appropriate language, they're indicating their willfulness to do whatever they want to do, which seems to involve a shared ignorance and unwillingness to talk about the Declaration of Independence and the First Amendment to the US Constitution, right? Whether we're talking, some of us are local governors or mayors, or whether we're talking about people in our government in Washington, DC. So scientism is ruling the roost right now. So there isn't much room for discussions questioning this. And then why would science need to push back? There's no counterinsurgency underway. Nothing to push back against.
It is something that Christians, as people of the Word, would recognize the sacredness. First of all, the sacred Scripture, but then also of our own national texts. And you see that debate, you know, happening in the Supreme Court, etc. You know, who's going to look at the text versus? Okay. We should probably want, but I would, maybe could we finish with a word of encouragement? So give us an application on how we stand in the midst of all, as the ruins collapse, as the darkness falls and we're waiting for the day star to rise in our hearts, and we have this clarity on the limits of science, but we're in a world that has science with no limits. This is not the first time the church has faced this, you know, certainly. But so how about maybe a final word of warning or encouragement as we sign off?
Well, I'm not sure I have enough optimism to do that. So what we're going to have to do is, you reminded me because you said of the church. So I see no room for optimism in our culture today, because our culture is characterized by the rejection, as I said, of Christ and his word. Though this was an intimate hallmark of Western thought through the medieval period up until modernity. So I don't see any room for optimism whenever we're using scientific solutions or science as a solution to our individual lives or to our lives and our society and culture together. However, as you and I both know, Luther said, the Christian is an optimist. So the thing to keep an eye on is the means of grace. It is texts. So the really bothersome thing about science is not exactly precisely that, you know, with some blessed exceptions from some powerful Christian scientists and Christian science professors that I know, right? With some exceptions, but the real problem is not just the godlessness of the natural sciences, but it's the anti-textual character of them. So how do you remedy this? By teaching the texts, and especially the text of Scripture. I think maybe you would let me get away with saying that this is room for hope in our conversation and in our friends and interested folks listening in on the conversation. There is the opportunity right here and now to be turning to those sacred texts for the United States, which I think would be a very good, necessary thing, which are in turn grounded in the sacred text of Holy Scripture. So I think we should call on all the people of the book. You mentioned Christians. I would say our Orthodox Jewish friends too, to share the words of Scripture and let it loose to do its work in our classrooms and in our national conversation, and certainly in our conversations with each other. And then people like you and me are also privileged to be preaching and teaching this stuff. So we hope that people would make use of our books, that they would come and hear our sermons or listen to our sermons online and hear that text, which changes everything. The text which does come right from God and does address us as the full human beings that we are, and shows us in an age of boredom and death on demand that we are infinitely valuable to God. Texts that show us that ethics not only are doable, but find their center in Christ, who has been given all authority, all normativity in heaven and on earth. There is room for great hope there. As long as we can have conversations like this, there's room for hope.
And we're having it, of all places, on YouTube. How about that? for now. To the text, Isaiah says, to the word. That's the call of the prophet, always back to the word of God, and we rejoice in that. And I'm so thankful. I'm twice as smart as I was when we started this conversation. Or maybe even two-thirds smarter. So let's see. Lutheranphilosopher.com. Dr. Schulz has has a bunch of your stuff, including podcasts, books, blogs, writings. So that's a great place for people to go. We'll put the link below. And this is hopefully just the first of a number of conversations that we'll be able to have. So God be praised for that. If you have thoughts, if those of you watching, listening have thoughts, if you post those down below, and we'll maybe even keep an eye on those questions, see if we can circle back around as well. Any concluding thoughts? Thank you so much for your time, by the way. God be praised. Any final thoughts?
these conversations are to be absolutely coveted and cultivated and shared, especially in this time of national crisis, or maybe it's cultural crisis that we're really in the midst of. This is pure gold. And, you know, I'm just going to speak for all of us listening or participating in one way, Brian. This is just a great gift for you to hand in to us to help us with everything.
Oh, God be praised. The Lord's word is always, it makes its way through, and it's it reminds us why. This is just a good reminder why the Lord didn't give us a science textbook, but he gave us the book of the prophets and the apostles, which are true all the way through. I mean, from the dirt to the stars, and from the soul to the beauty of the face of God, through all the way through. God be praised for that. Thanks so much, Dr. Schultz, Pastor Schultz. Really appreciate your time, and God's peace be with everyone else.
If this interview stuff is fun for you, then please let me know. And probably the best way to keep in touch with all these things is to subscribe to the Wednesday Whatnot, www.wolfmuller.co/Wednesday. And that's the way to keep in touch, especially if something weird happens and we're not on YouTube anymore, or we disappear from all the other places. That will be a way to keep in touch. So go sign up there. On the website, there's a ton of free stuff as well. And we'll try to put all the links to the references that we mentioned in the book, or in the interview, sorry. We'll put all the books and stuff down below as well. So you should be able to find all that too. Thanks. God's peace be with you. Thanks again for being a podcast listener. I like this podcasting stuff. This is kind of cool. Anyway, wolfmuller.co, it's a website where everything is, so you can find it there. If you thought this was a helpful conversation, then please do share it. And let me know if you'd like to have more like this. I think Dr. Schultz and I are going to have a series of conversations on, well, we're going to talk about the failure of the church to teach people how to lament, and how to recover that. That's coming up here pretty soon. So we're going to try to do this once a month or so and keep the conversation going. Wednesday Whatnot, you got to sign up for that? I think that's all. If you want to come to Germany with us, you better tell us in the next couple of days. It's 1st of March, and that list is due on March the 4th. So let us know. We got a few spots open for a June trip to Germany. Hopefully we'll be able to do that. All the other announcements you'll find on the website. Thanks again for being a podcast listener. God's peace be with you.